Okay, so today we'll speak about technology. Yesterday we spoke about performance, and of course we had to touch on technology because this machine is performance driven, and most of the technical systems are there to permit to reach the aggressive performance of the LHC. But we'll concentrate today on I would say the most specific technologies to this machine. That is supervending magnets, including their firing and protection, cryogenics, and vacuum. And if we have time, we speak about project management. Otherwise, you will find this in the copies. Okay. So, if you want to produce a uniform field in a laterally accessible volume, the usual trick is to use something called Helmholtz coils, which you see here. And if your useful volume is extended along the circumference of an accelerator, you want to deform these coils so that they fit best to the useful volumes, which is essentially the beam tube. So this explains more or less the shape of these coils for accelerator magnets. In fact, if we go a little bit more into the current distribution, with the ideal current distribution, which is required to produce a uniform field, a good way to explain it is to start with the magnetic field inside a conducting cylinder. So if I apply Ampere's theorem on this the circulation of the field on this curved path is equal to mu zero times the current enclosed. And then I can calculate that the field is proportional to the current density times the radius of this path here, divided by 2. So now if I don't look at this black crescent for the time being. If I take one conductor here with one current in one direction, producing a field here, so this field has components along X and Y, which you can see here. And if I take another identical conductor with the current in the opposite direction, I can also write the field components here with the radius being R2 here. So it's here it's minus R1 cosine theta 1. Here it's plus R2 cosine theta 2. And the same thing with the BX component. So if I bring now, if I superimpose these two conductors, I can then take away the overlap region, because since each cylindrical conductor conducted equally and opposite currents, there's no current in the white region in the center, so I can take the conductor away, and this leaves me a hole. And then the field in this region happens to be uniform in the y direction, equal to mu zero times current density times S, where S is the distance, is R2, R1 minus R2, or R2 minus R1, the distance between the two centers here. So this is known, you find this in all electromagnetic textbooks. So the ideal distribution to produce uniform field is intersecting ellipses, intersecting circles, but it can be generalized to ellipses. And similarly, to produce quadrupole field, you can have this type of intersecting ellipses. Of course, this is not an engineering shape. It's not so easy to wind conductors along this geometry. So no, in practice, one tends to approximate this shape, which is incidentally called cosine theta, because if I call theta the azimuthal angle here, the current density or the current varies as the cosine of the angle from maximum value here to zero here. So in practice, you approximate this by winding a cable or a wire along windable geometries, I would say. So this type of layers here, which you even approximate either by so-called blocks of conductor or layers or this type of winding here. Of course, if you do that, you don't have the perfect current distribution, so you don't have the perfectly homogeneous field, and this is You remember this picture of the Goodfield region? It meant that even with your conductors in the best possible placements, that is no error in construction, as designed, you will not create a perfectly homogeneous field, but you will approximate it. So that's for field homogeneity. Now for field strength. If you consider a single layer coil, in LHC we have two layers for, again, technical reasons, the width of the cable. You can calculate the central field or the dipole component, which is proportional to the current density, which I call technical. It means it's the average current density in that conductor block times the width of the coil, which is here. You see that the aperture does not play a role. Now, so from this and from the properties of superconductors, namely the current carrying capacity versus field, which gives me another relation between B and J, I can work out what is the width of a coil to produce a given field. So you remember that the critical current density, or if you want the current carrying capacity of superconductors versus field, was a decreasing curve. And for niobium titanium, it can be very simply modelized by this type of relation. Red at 4.2 Kelvin and blue at 1.9 Kelvin, where you shift this curve by about 3 Tesla. So if you fold in these two relations and you try to work out what happens, that is, you calculate the coil width, or the coil thickness, if you want, as a function of the field, the field of the superconductor, the central field in the magnet, you see these types of curves. You see that beyond 8 Tesla, to produce significant fields with niobium titanium, you need very thick coils. And of course, it's a law of diminishing returns, because you add conductors to the outside of the coil, they are far from the useful field region, and they are less and less efficient. So this diverges. Incidentally, I've put also the points representative of the dipoles of a few machines here. If you run at 1.9 Kelvin, since you have again more current density at high field, you can design magnets in that field range here with reasonable coil thicknesses. If you not only look at the coil thickness, but you look at the coil cross-section, which eventually is an indication of the total amount of superconductor which you put in your magnets, and therefore the cost of the superconductor, the curves are even, the rise is even sharper. So clearly, this shows that there's no way to design cosine theta magnets, dipoles, beyond 8 Tesla with niobium titanium. So either you have to go to more exotic materials, niobium 310, as already mentioned, or you go to lower temperature, which we did for LHC. Okay, then, as I mentioned, we build these coils in two layers, because the thickness which is required, which you find here, is 30 millimeters. And making a 30 millimeter wide cable is technically difficult, and then difficult to wind. So in fact, we designed the coil in two layers. And then if you do so, you can play another trick, which is called current grading. That is, you see here a map, a field map of the or a map of the field produced by the coils. And we showed only the field level in the coils. Of course, you want to produce field here. But since this field is also seen by the superconductor, this is what limits your performance. What you see clearly here is that the outer layer sees less field than the inner layer. So if this is so, you can say, aha, but then I can design the outer layer maybe with a higher current density. And then I can optimize my structure. This is called current grading. It enables to make more efficient magnets. And you see here the two load lines of the two layers. So the red lines are the critical lines of the superconductor. Again, current density versus field. And you see that the two load lines are, that is the field produced by the each layer for a given current density, are different, which enables us to run the outer layer at lower field and higher current density, but with about the same distance to the critical line, that is the same operational margin. The price to pay for this is that you have to include the splice in between the coil layers, and which will be, this is the way, the location to do it in between the two layers. After that, it will be just, I would say, fitted into the coil structure, so totally inaccessible. So this splice has to be good and has to remain good. So we worked a lot on this, but I think that's we have now a good solution. Okay, the cable which we use, what the design of the magnet tells you is, in fact, the total number of amperes or ampere turns which you need. You can have this with many amperes and few turns, or many turns and few amperes, but this changes the picture as far as inductance is concerned. And therefore, voltage when powering the magnet. So you want to keep the inductance reasonably low, so you have to go to high currents, and this is why you design, in fact, cables which are constituted of a few tens of strands. Each strand is about 1 millimeter diameter. Looks like copper, but because actually the superconducting filaments, which have been revealed here by etching, are enclosed in a copper matrix. You see here micrograph where you see the niobium titanium filaments, and this is the matrix. These filaments are a few micrometers in diameter for reasons essentially of stability and of field quality. I will explain it in a moment. And this cable must also be very tightly toleranced geometrically, since again, if the cable is not precise, the winding will not be precise, and then the field quality will degrade. So the problem with superconductors is that they remain superconducting. That is, even when you stop the transport current, there are induced currents, for example, by the application of external fields in each filament, which tend to screen the inside of the conductor to prevent it from entering the bulk of the filament. And these currents, of course, depend on the powering history, depend on the filament geometry, and then it means that when you switch off the current in a superconducting magnet, there remains local current loops which produce some remanent field or field errors. You can calculate this. It's a kind of remanent magnetization, if you want. So from the field map, you can calculate the remanent magnetization, and you can show that the magnetization of such a filament is directly proportional to the diameter of the filament. So if you want to reduce this effect of remanence or persistent current, as they are called, you have to design with very small filaments. Still, these filaments produce unavoidable multiple errors. So if you have here one of these filaments with its remanent magnetization modeled as a dipole, you have here a kind of magnetization cycle or hysteresis cycle. This is magnetization, this is field, applied field of a strand. And from this, you can calculate the field error, which is, in the case of a dipole, essentially a sextupolar field error. So this can be modeled again, but and it can be compensated within limits, because you see, as you see, the position, you can be anywhere in this cycle depending on upon your powering history. If you power along this line and then down along this line, if you go down to zero, you will close your cycle here. But if you go only down to this value, you will close your cycle here and start again on the powering curve here. So again, this sets, in fact, the limit of the reproducibility of the field in your magnets, unless you track the powering history and you have a more complicated model, computer model, which enables you to take into account these effects, which we have tried to implement in LHC. Okay, production, a few pictures. We had to produce 7,500 kilometers of this cable. So it meant a lot of wire produced in clean conditions in many places in the world, in Europe, in the US, in Japan. Then a lot of typical, I would say, wire making techniques, extrusion, drawing, cabling, etc., and a lot of quality control. Overall, you see here the data for the two types of cable over the production history with the different vendors. Each color corresponds to a different vendor. We were always typically 10% above the specified critical current, but we also tried to keep under control the magnetization, that is the remnant field due to the persistent current, and the interstrand resistance, which also controls the decay of field when we switch off the current. And this was achieved with a low rejection or declassification rate, thanks to, I would say, quality controls at many steps. You must realize that this material costs about the cost of silver, so you don't want to reject too much of it. Okay, then the cable is insulated by a double wrap in polyimide, which has to have a nice dielectric properties, but also nice mechanical properties, because this thing sees very high stresses during powering, and also preserve permeability to cool the cable. I will say a word on it on cryogenics. You see here the cut of the assembled cable in a coil. What I didn't mention is that you see the cable is not really rectangular. It's more a trapeze shape. We call it keystoned. So that when you stack it, it stacks along this so-called arch shape geometry. So what you see here is the insulation around each cable, and then you have other ground insulation which protects the coil from the structural components of the magnet. Then you manufacture coils with this, so you need also heavy tooling, because you want to make these magnets as long as possible. To reduce their number, we settled on something like 15 meters, which you can still manipulate and transport. But you need it means you need the 20 meter long winding machines. You need still a lot of hand work, manual work, I would say, for the ends. And then you see here coils which have been extracted from the mold and which are waiting their assembly in the structure. So now let's speak a little bit about the structure. Superconducting currents means high fields, high current, so high electromagnetic forces. You see here the pattern of forces in transverse forces in a coil. And the shape of this coil is not it cannot react these forces integrally. It can react if it's assembled in an arch. It can react the azimuthal component, but it cannot react the radial component. So you need a shrinking system or pre-stressed structure around the coil to contain the radial components. Given the fact that you want to avoid all motion, all deformation, and strong forces to not to lose your in-field quality, but also not to have spurious movements of your cable, which could release locally heat and quench your magnet. The calculation is very simple. If you take 10 Tesla and 10 kiloamps, which is typically the order of magnitude of our field and current, you find 10 to the fifth newton per meter per turn. And we have something like 30 turns or so. So it means huge forces, about the weight of 747 Boeing on every meter of magnet. You see here the weights assembled. So these are two sets of coils, or with double layers. You can see it clearly here. And the way to contain these forces is to clamp them into so-called collars. Since these structures have to be precise to typically a few hundredths of a millimeter, the cheapest way to have them, to make them, is to punch lamination and to stack them. Punching is a very good way to get precision at a very low cost. Then another trick which we played, in fact, which we borrowed from our colleagues in Brookhaven, laboratory in the US, is to assemble, to make twin Apache magnets. We need, as you know, two magnetic channels in the with opposite fields in the LHC. And the standard way would have been to design single magnets, single channel magnets, and install them next to each other. But if we assemble two sets of coils in a common shrinking structure, and if these coils share a common magnetic yoke, what can be more efficient in terms of space usage, transverse space usage, and also field level. In other words, part of the ampere turns of the of these coils on the left are used to produce the field on the right, and reciprocally. So in fact, the field circulates like this. The price to pay for this is crosstalk between the apertures, but normally we can live with it since we plan to operate this machine at with the same field on the two beams, the same energy on the two beams, and therefore the same field on the two apertures. So you see here the way it's assembled. To get the right field homogeneity and precision, you need typically to have the winding precise at better than 0.05 of a millimeter. So to guarantee this, you need heavy tooling to so that your objects which come out of the production lines are reproducible. You see here the what we call the core masses of these magnets, 15 meter long, about 600 meters in diameter. They are bent to follow the curvature of the tunnel and not to lose aperture. So typical tolerances are 9 millimeter sag over the length, but plus or minus 1 millimeter. And to guarantee this in a in an industrial production, you have to have rigid tooling like big presses, etc. Well-defined welding procedures, and that worked quite well, I would say. So after that, you have to install the magnet into a cryostat so that to permit its operation at low temperature. And this was done by industry as well, but at CERN in a workshop which we specially designed for it. And then after this, the magnets were, each of them was tested on the test bench cryogenically at operating temperature. So these tests aimed at training of the, or checking the training of these magnets. So what is the training? If you power a magnet wound with a conductor which has a short sample limit, so-called short sample, the limit of the conductor is given by this line, normally it will not go straight away to that value. It will start to quench, that is to show a resistive transition at a lower value. And then the first time you power it, and the second time it will go a bit higher, etc., until it will reach a kind of plateau. It's very rare that you reach this short sample limit, and this is due essentially to settling of the conductors in their ideal position, and to the fact that there are still stresses remaining in the structure which can be released by powering. So, for this reason, we design an operating current significantly below the short sample limit, and of course, what must be we must check is that we can get to this nominal operating current with some margin. So this was done, and you see here that on virgin dipoles, for example, we reached the nominal field on with 0, 1, or 2 quenches for most of the magnets. For these here, they were thermally cycled and retested. And again, after 0, 1, or 2 quenches, the remaining ones got to the design value. Since that time, they were stored, as you may have heard, they were stored for some of them up to 2 years in the open air before installation, and some of them have lost this training, or part of this training. So we would have probably to redo in situ training in the machine to get the machine up to the nominal value of 7 TeV, which corresponds to 8.3 Tesla. We also checked field quality, and you see here versus the production number, some estimators of field quality. This is the main bending power. This is the main first error, the sextuple error in the dipoles with the control limits. The different curves correspond to the different vendors, and That's also an achievement, that you see that the scatter or the difference between production lines is of the same order of magnitude as the scatter within each vendor. So clearly the production, whether it comes from Italy, from France, from Germany, is very homogeneous. You cannot really tell which magnets come from where. And that was one of the aims, so that we would not have to deal with separate populations, as, for example, our colleagues in HERA had to do with the German and Italian magnets, which had clearly different characteristics. After that, we had to, before giving clearance for installation, we had to inspect all the manufacturing and test data, and then do a specific sorting, which enabled to improve or to reduce the scatter of the different of the magnets as installed in the LHC sectors. One of the criteria was to sort by geometry, to take into advantage of the fact that the beam size varies along the cell. So we had different classes based on the geometrical error of the axis of these magnets. And then we affected the we allocated the silver magnets to where the field is smaller. We also sorted on sectupole error, and sorting enables us to reduce scatter by, for example, by pairing. This is called flip-flop pairing. That is, we put, if we have a magnet with an error in one direction, we put the magnet with the error in, an error in the other direction, and about equal next to it, so that globally the beam doesn't see anything. Another way is to pair at with the phase advance of pi, so that you take two magnets with the same error and you put them at pi phase difference in the Betatron oscillation, so that the effect is compensated. So that was done, and in fact it was permitted by, this is the view of this open air storage, it was permitted by the fact that installation proceeded faster than production. So we had always a buffer between these two delivery or these two lines, and which enabled us to play this game. And overall, you see an example of the result here on one sector. Oh no, I'm sorry, on all the sectors. You see the, again, this is the sextuple field error, which is the main random error in a dipole. And you see the bars V1 and V2 correspond to the two apertures of the magnets as they were measured, and the darker bars correspond to the value after sorting. So you were able to gain typically a factor of 3 or more on the scatter of the field errors in the sectors, and then build a machine which is in fact better than its components. Okay, after that there was a big chantier of installation, lower these magnets in the tunnel, transport them, put them in place, and proceed to interconnections. So we had to interconnect the superconducting bars, 65,000 electrical joints, which were made by soldering or by welding, but in all cases using automatic machines with programmed procedures, so that we try to reduce the human factor in all these things. It didn't totally work, as you know, but at least we were able to. This was done by a company with no previous experience of this type of work. So we developed the technology, we imposed the tools and the procedures, and we just asked them to follow, and of course inspect it closely, but there was a few misses. After that, we had to do to close the circuits, and that meant 40,000 in situ junctions, which had to be helium tight, and which were also done by so-called orbital machines, that is automatic welding machines, again to reduce the human factor. So powering and protection. Once these magnets are installed in series in the tunnel, you have to feed them in current from the room temperature environment where you have a power converter. And so this is the role of these feed boxes, which are one at each end of the arc. So this is a kind of continuous cryostat for 3 kilometers. And at each end, you have current feed-throughs into the cryogenic environment. Now, cryogenic current leads have been studied for a long time, because it's a nice calculation which you can do. You have different processes at work. You have, of course, conduction along the conductor. You have Joule heating, since you carry a current, and you have you want to minimize the heating leak into the helium bath, of course. And then, so for this, you use gas cooling using the vapor boil-off from the bath. So the problem is that, as you know, metals follow what is called the Wiedemann-Franz-Lorentz law, which tells you that good electrical conductors are usually good thermal conductors. That's not what you want. So in fact, the optimal sizing of these leads made in normal metals results from a compromise. If you design them too small, they will conduct less heat, but they may burn upon under Joule heating. If you make them too big, you will be plagued with higher heating leak. So an ideal leak, current lead should be made from a material with excellent electrical conductance and low thermal conductance. And this is precisely the definition of a superconductor. So if you could make these objects out of superconductors in the superconducting state, you would solve all your problems. The problem is that this lead spans a temperature range from 4 Kelvin here to room temperature. So we don't have yet superconductors at room temperature. But then the idea is to use the lower part, superconductors for the lower part of these leads. In fact, this was a niche application for high-temperature superconductors, which we realized the potential very early. We launched developments with industry, and we validated them. So you see here a 13 kiloamp lead. The top part is made of copper under an insulating material, which you see here. And the lower part is made of so-called BISCO 2223, which is one of the high TC superconductors available on the market. And with this, typically, you reduce the specific heating leak to the liquid helium baths from the optimum for Wiedemann-Franz-Lorentz metals of 1.1 watts per kiloamp to typically a tenth of this. Of course, you still have to cool the upper part, so your exergetic load is only factor 3 better, and not a factor 10. Since we have a very large or very numerous and large currents to feed into this machine, total of 1.7 million amperes, we need current leads in and out for 3.4 million amperes. And the fact of using HTS-based materials enables us to save about 5,000 liters per hour of liquid helium. That is the cost of an extra plant and more than 3 megawatts of running. So it was a good choice. It was a nice project, because it was trying to use the development of emerging materials, and it works. You see them mounted in turrets in the machine. Okay, to power these magnets, you need also high current power converters. The technology which is used now is switched mode power converters, which behave really as current, true current sources. And since we had many different ratings, in fact, we built them out of modular units. For example, this is a 12 kiloamp unit, which is made from the stacking several 2 kiloamp units. You need to control this with high precision, typically a few ppm. And for this, you need, of course, elaborate measurement and control, but this was achieved. And you see here, typically, the programmed ramping of or simultaneous ramping or deramping of the power converters in a sector to simulate a ramp, and then here what we call the squeeze, that is when we squeeze the beams for luminosity runs. Okay, so much for powering protection. Superconductors are basically unstable. That is, as again, if I plot here, this time the current versus the temperature, this is another critical curve, the trace of the critical surface in this plane. And clearly, if my operating point is here and I have some perturbation which increases the temperature, I will destroy superconductivity and I will quench my magnet. Unfortunately, the heat capacity of solid materials, as you know, decreases at low temperature. It's very clear that the result of this is that, and particularly at 1.9 Kelvin, a few microjoules local deposition is enough to create this transition here. So I tried to put some numbers, typical numbers. Temperature margin of the superconductor, that is the distance to this curve in operation at the design point, is about 1.5 Kelvin. The specific quench energy, that is the energy to heat the conductor to cross this curve, is about 10 millijoules per cubic centimeter. You have to compare this with the energy which is stored inductively in each magnet, about 7 megajoules, or the beam energy. And this shows you that you cannot tolerate many beam losses to quench these magnets. So you want to stabilize the conductor. A good way to stabilize it is what is called electrodynamic stabilization. That is, you put the conductor in contact with a good conductivity material, copper in this case. And then if you cross this line, part of the current is bypassed in the copper. And if you have sufficient copper cross-section, you can accommodate an excursion beyond this line, and you can even recover in some cases. Another way to stabilize is to use the fact that the specific heat of helium is large as compared to that of solid materials. And if you can guarantee good porosity of your coil, if you can make sure that you have some, even a few percent is sufficient, a few percent helium in the coil, you improve its effective heat capacity and therefore its stability. The fact of having a cable is also normally at a nice way, because this is again the quench energy versus the ratio of current to critical current of a single strand in the cable. And of course, if you have 30 strands, normally it should be 30 times more. Provided if you have a local energy deposition, the current can redistribute. But this only occurs up to a fraction of the critical current. At high current, the current cannot redistribute to the other strands. And then if you deposit even a small amount of energy, you will quench your whole cable. And the spectrum of perturbations is quite wide. We have almost continuous heating leaks. You have heating leaks at the level of a fraction of a second, and then some of them lower than 1 millisecond. So in fact, the way your conductor reacts to thermal perturbations depends on the time scale of these perturbations. Because for very short ones, clearly the neighboring helium will not have time to participate. And so we ran simulations of the cable with the helium content, the possible conduction to the outside. And this is typically what you get. For example, this line is the enthalpy of the cable only. This is the enthalpy of the cable with the helium. And you see that you don't really benefit totally from this added enthalpy for short energy depositions, short time scales like millisecond, because there the coupling to the helium is not sufficient. Now, you try to do your best to stabilize your conductor, But still, there will be cases where the energy deposition will be too large and you will quench your magnet. So what happens then? Then the quench, that is the local region of the conductor which becomes resistive, starts to dissipate, of course. It sees the full current. And if you start to, or if by any process you decrease the current, you can calculate by energy balance that the energy dissipation in the conductor, which has now become resistive, is equal to the heat capacity times the increase in temperature. And if you write this equation by moving the temperature-dependent parameters, which is resistivity and specific heat, to the right, you can have here dissipation integral, which depends only on the time profile of the current decay, and here an integral which depends only on the properties of your conductor as a function of temperature. So this enables you to calculate the hotspot in your magnet after a quench, even if you don't know where this hotspot is. And you see that, so in jargon, you may see that in articles, this is expressed, this dissipation integral is expressed in mega ampere squared seconds, which is called mites. Don't ask me why. Again, if you want to protect your magnet, you want typically to spread your dissipation over the maximum possible volume of conductor, so that your hotspot is lower in temperature. And the way to do this is a heater. That is, you detect the appearance of a quench and you fire a heater to quench a large volume of coil to propagate your quench. So before the quench, you want your conductor to be, or your coil to be, as stable as possible. But once you have detected the quench, you want it to become as unstable as possible so that you dissipate the energy over the maximum volume. So you see these two requirements go against each other. So this gives us the total protection scheme of this this type of magnet chain. You see here a magnet chain which covers 3 kilometers of a sector. So the first thing to do if you detect a quench, a magnet quenching, so instead of having just a pure resistance, a pure inductance, you have an appearance of a resistance here. You fire the heater, which is powered by the discharge of a capacitor, which is kept always charged, to spread the quench over the maximum volume of conductor. Then you send a signal to the power converter to tell it to go down. But of course, all the energy is stored in the inductively in the chain of magnets, so it will take some time to decrease the current. You also switch these two resistors in the circuit to discharge as much as possible of the energy externally, but in doing so, of course, you create a high voltage, and you don't want this voltage to destroy the insulation of your magnet, so you're limited to typically a few hundred volts, or 1 kilowatt maximum. And finally, you want to avoid that all the stored energy during the decrease of current in the circuit is dissipated into this resistance here. Otherwise, even if this magnet supports its own or resists its own quench, it would not resist the dissipation of all this energy here. So you want to bypass the magnet, which has quenched, by automatic switch, which is a diode, in fact, in parallel to the magnet terminals, and which, as soon as it sees the appearance of a few volts, there starts to become conducting. So we have such diodes, large current diodes, in parallel to all the magnets, and we have these big switches and discharge resistors where you want to dissipate megajoules of energy in essentially in blocks of stainless steel. Let's speak a little bit on cryogenics. So you want to cool a machine on a 27 kilometer circumference. You have only access from limited number of points, and in any case you want you don't want to multiply the number of cryogenic plants. So you see already that one of the problems is to transport heat over long distances. If you do it at low temperature, you want to transport this heat with very small temperature differences. You know since Fourier that heat flow is always associated with temperature difference. But of course, temperature differences at low absolute temperature create a lot of irreversibilities. So this is here, this picture, I try to show that the problem is essentially to transport kilowatts of power over kilometers of distance under minute delta T's. And at LHC, we have little more than a tenth of a degree budget from the furthest magnet to the cryogenic plant. So to do this, we cool with superfluid helium. This is the phase diagram of helium. Instead of having the solid here, you have the so-called helium-2. And we operate in pressurized helium-2, which is in fact subcooled liquid. This is the first installation to have used this cooling scheme was the Torsupra-Tokamak in France. Then we had, as far as accelerators are concerned, CBAF was the first machine cooled by superfluid helium, but using this time saturated helium-2. And LHC uses a similar system as Torsupra, except that it is spread over many kilometers. So that's the view of these two machines. The LHC system is also significantly larger than the previous systems in terms of helium inventory. We have 80 tons of superfluid helium, and also in terms of refrigeration power. So we had clearly to develop the technology beyond the previous state of the art to cope with these quantum jumps, I would say. So superfluid helium, you may know that superfluidity was discovered in 1938 by Alan Meissner in Cambridge and Kapitsa in Moscow. When you pump on a helium bath and you raise, when you reach the transition temperature, the boiling stops, even if you apply heat in this heater here. In fact, the reason for this is that the heat conduction in this liquid is so high that the liquid doesn't need to boil to transport the heat to the surface. So the heat is conducted by conduction in the liquid and then evaporates from the surface. So that's one characteristic of superfluids. The other one is that the viscosity is extremely small, so that the fluid can permeate through very fine pores. And this is, of course, a nice feature if you want to stabilize superconducting windings. Okay, let me go through that rapidly. What we use is this fluid as a coolant. So it has a viscosity which is typically 100 times lower than water. It has a very high specific heat as compared to that of the conductor, so it's a good stabilizer. And it's got a very high thermal conductivity. It conducts, maybe this is the most impressive, it conducts 1,000 times or more, several thousand times better than copper, the best possible copper, oxygen-free high conductivity copper at this temperature. So in fact, you can design a cooling system with this fluid, which does not need to have, for example, pumps or all the problems which are associated with fluid cooling usually. So we see that in this insulation, which is try to preserve the porosity of. This is a heat transport characteristic across this insulation measured on samples. So you see here the delta T versus the heating power. This is the red curve is typically the what is given by the solid conduction across the insulator. And you see that you short circuit this insulator as long as you are in below the lambda point, you are in a superfluid state. By having a heat transport curve which is much more efficient than the bare conduction through the conductor, through the insulant, The way we use it in LHC is the string of the magnets operate in pressurized baths, so it's subcooled liquid, no bubbles, static, no pumps. And the string of magnets is traversed by a heat exchanger tube, a copper tube, in which we flow two-phase saturated helium-2. So as long as you have two phases present, you have a monovariant system. That is, the temperature is fixed only by the vapor pressure there, independently of the heat load. And you can then guarantee quasi-homogeneity of your temperature. And this is what we measure, in fact, on the sector of the LHC. This is 3.3 kilometers. This is cooled by a refrigeration plant, which is at this end here. And you see these are the temperature of the magnets all along the sector, which are within a few hundredths of a degree. So we have a very good cooling system, which enables to stabilize the magnets. Okay, cryogenics mean also big plants, which European industry can produce. Essentially, big compressors of helium with a large installed power, typically 4 megawatts on each station. Heat exchangers and expansion turbines in cold boxes to produce the liquid. That can be procured by industry again, from industry. What we tried to do in view of the large installed capacity was to put a premium on having efficient machines. And in fact, one way to do that was to include the operating costs in the adjudication formula. So that is, we did not buy the cheapest plant, we bought the cheapest plant, including 10 years of integrated operation. And the vendors reacted favorably to that by designing plants with a better efficiency than the previous state of the art. Still, you have to refrigerate at 1.8 Kelvin, so you have to somehow compress or get this saturated vapor here, which is at 20 millibar, which is a saturation pressure corresponding to 1.8 Kelvin, back to atmospheric pressure. So this means very high compression ratio. Normally, on small laboratory equipment, you do it with vacuum pumps. Then you would need very large vacuum pumps, and this would be very inefficient in the LHC. So the idea is to compress the gas at maximum density, that is when it's cold. If you want a compressor which operates cold, it cannot be lubricated. So it cannot have mechanical contacts. And it means you need to use hydrodynamic machines with high efficiency, which again we developed with industry in several countries to preserve competition, and which we finally procured from two vendors. So these machines work. Then you have to cool down the sectors. I discussed with some of you last night, I guess, about this. We have to cool down large masses, essentially of iron, which you can only pre-cool by vaporizing liquid nitrogen. So you have to bring to the site large amounts of liquid nitrogen in a limited stretch of time, which is essentially a question of money and organization. That enabled us to cool these sectors. We had to learn. You see clearly here the learning curve. And also to verify that the heat loads are comparable to what we expected. In fact, I illustrated this with two types of features which we use for thermal insulation. One is multi-layer reflective insulation. We have 9 hectares, 90,000 square meters of cold surface area in the LHC. And if you calculate the black body radiation from room temperature falling on that surface, it gives you 4 megawatts per hectare. So this means 36 megawatts of heating. So clearly you want to cut that as much as possible. And one way is to use this multi-layer reflective insulation. It's aluminized mylar film with spacer materials. And with this type of things, you can bring the heat flux to typically 1 watt per square meter, which is 10 kilowatts per hectare, so a factor 40 with respect to the black body radiation. So that was implemented systematically, of course. And another source of heat in leak came from the supporting of this machine, 37,500 tons, over supports which on which you can develop the thermal profile over typically 20 centimeters from room temperature down to the core mass. So in fact, if you design, you can make a simple calculation. If you design with a material which can tolerate a compressive stress of 50 newtons per square millimeter, you need 7.5 square meters of material, which is a huge conduction path. And the way, again, to go around this is to use low conductivity material. So what is called G10, it's an epoxy glass fiber composite material, which constitutes these columns here. And to have a heat interception at two levels, to try and take most of the conduction heat away at higher temperature. So this we finally verified globally in the machine by enthalpy balance measurements. And we verified that, for example, our budget of 0.2 watt per meter on the coal mass was achieved. So the machine is essentially as it should there. If you want to look at the state of the machine, you can look at the LHC website, where this is normally refreshed, and you can find the temperature of the different sectors. Okay, I still have some time to speak briefly about vacuum, and I will stop there after that. We saw that, remember that to the beam vacuum lifetime had to be sufficiently large not to degrade the beams more, for example, than the luminosity of the machine. So remember this value of 100 hours, which made this effect not the main one for degradation of the circulating beams. Another benefit of having a high lifetime, that is a slow decay of the beam intensity by scattering of the protons on the gas molecules, is that we have this reduces the energy deposited. These stray particles are eventually lost in the cryogenic environment, and we didn't want that to add again to the heat load. So the if we call tau gas this lifetime, tau gas is given by the proton velocity times the sum over the gas species of the scattering cross sections times the gas densities for different present species. And in fact, the pressure, the partial pressure corresponding to the species, as you know, is proportional directly to the gas density and to temperature. So if you make the calculation, taking the nuclear scattering cross sections on these atoms here, you find that you want gas densities which do not exceed 10 to the 14 or 10 to the 15 molecules per cubic meter. In other words, at 5 Kelvin, pressures on the order of 10 to the minus 8 Pascal. Fine, so you can design your system so that the outgassing, if you put sufficient pumping speed, the dynamic pressure resulting from the competition between the pumping and the outgassing gives you these values. Fortunately, when you have beam, you have a number of effects which desorb the trapped molecules from the surface here by photons, as we have seen already, by electrons, by ions, and this adds to the gas load. So you want to design systems to pump more effectively. And one of the systems is the beam screen, since by inserting a beam screen in between the beam and the cold surface, you protect the cold surface from the impact of this radiation. So you limit desorption. And then you can still benefit from the cryopumping on the cold surface. So if I plot the saturation pressures of the different species as a function of temperature, and if this is, for example, hydrogen, take this one, you see that the saturation pressure of all these gases, except helium, which is here, vanish at low temperature, at 1.9 Kelvin. And this is the line corresponding to the 100 hours lifetime for hydrogen. So you have to clearly to stay below this point which you can do by cryopumping in absence of gas desorption induced by the beam at this temperature. With the beam screen, you can, as I said, you can protect the cold surface, and this is a measurement of the evolution of the gas desorb without beam screen and with beam screen, where you see that the pumping starts to play a role here through the holes, and you can contain the pressure rise due to the gas desorption. This was measured on a synchrotron radiation machine. It was a test. Now, some of the magnets operate at 4.5 Kelvin, and if you play the same trick at 4.5 Kelvin, you see that you are too high in residual saturation pressure and well above the Hans-Rodauer lifetime for hydrogen line. So you want somehow to bring back your point here, and this can not be done only by condensation pumping, by cryopumping, but you can use physical sorption to improve or to get additional pumping. And this is what we use in the 4.5 Kelvin magnets, where we use a cryosorber, which is a carbon fiber mesh, which has a high sorbing capabilities, and which enables to also contain this this vacuum in the magnets operating at higher than 1.9 Kelvin. Finally, we have a number of sections at of the machine at room temperature. And there, the problem was also to get some kind of distributed pumping, and that we did by using the same type of material as we used previously in LEP, that is using so-called non-evaporable getters, which are directly sputtered on the inner wall of the vacuum chamber. And you see here, for example, the effect of a pressure increase if you bombard a surface by electrons at room temperature, surface at room temperature with electrons. This is a bare stainless steel surface, and this is a surface which is coated with one of these non-evaporable getters. So you see here three orders of magnitude gain in the dynamic pressure. And again, the molecular desorption yield of these surfaces is also cut by, here in this case, two orders of magnitude. So we played this game. You have here for the few kilometers of room temperature vacuum chambers in the LHC, copper pipes which have been coated by coated in non-evaporable getters by sputtering, and you see them installed here in the rig. So this is the beam pipe is cold in the superconducting magnet. Here you have a room temperature to cold transition, and here you have these chambers. You have another two pictures here of stray lengths or drift lengths of vacuum pipe, here with two separate vacuum pipes, here close to a collision point where we have a common vacuum pipe. And again, this this pipe is fitted with the heating jackets for regenerating the getter. Okay, I think I will stop here. I will just you will look at by yourself at the last slides. I just want to show you this because, of course, this work is the work of many people, many more than this list, over many years. So clearly, I had to use the help of all my colleagues to prepare these talks. Thank you.
So are there any questions?
So could you say a little bit about the accelerating cavities?
Well, I can say a little bit. The accelerating cavities are not a big issue in the LHC because the power radiated per turn, as you have seen in terms of synchrotron radiation, is very small. So we don't need a lot of cavities. In fact, we have only 8 cavities on each beam. They are superconducting for a reason of, in fact, of beam impedance. They are superconducting because we could have them easily superconducting, since we have the cryogenics there. And the fact of having them superconducting enables to reduce the beam impedance in these cavities, so to reduce the instabilities associated with this. But it's a local equipment which is not very impressive, I would say. It's not left with these hundreds of meters of cavities.
Can you say a little bit about the quadrupole magnets? How frequently are they spaced?
Well, okay, I showed the cell yesterday. They are, so quadrupoles are every 50 meters typically. The lattice cell is three dipoles and a quadrupole. The idea was to maximize the length allocated to bending, to go to the highest possible energy in the given tunnel. And then, of course, the spacing of the quadrupole is given by how much you can tolerate the beam to swell before it's refocused. And the quadrupoles are also superconducting. They are used a similar cable as those of the dipoles. But of course, the stresses or the electromagnetic forces in the quadrupole are much lower than in a dipole. So technically, they are easier magnets to make. But they use basically the same technologies. I mean, that's the lattice quadrupole. I don't know, your question was on the low beta quadrupoles, on the focusing quadrupoles for the... Yes?
Is there an understanding by now why some of the dipoles lost their memory?
No.
Training?
No.
No idea?
We suppose that the fact of having them stored in the open air for again periods of up to I think 18 months or 2 years for some of them, so they underwent daily thermal cycles, yearly thermal cycles between the winter and summer, and that probably relaxed the pre-stresses in some of the structures. So. But we have no explanation. We tested this before deciding to store them like this on a few magnets, which showed no problem. But of course, we did not have the statistics. Now we have it.
Any other questions? Oh, we have them. Okay. That's all, then. Let's thank Philippe again.
Minor announcements.
Here we go. So first, the posters.
There are